This is WPRB Princeton, New Jersey, 103.3 FM, community supported independent radio. Now at 5 p.m., it's WPRB News and Culture. And I'm your host, Natalie Hahn. Join us here today at WPRB News and Culture as we explore the allure of knickknacks, the art of junking, and the sentimental value embedded within our possessions. In a world brimming with material abundance, what draws us to accumulate these tangible treasures? Is it the thrill of a hunt, the nostalgia of a bygone era, or simply the joy of surrounding ourselves with beautiful things? From vintage finds to modern marvels, we'll uncover the hidden gems nestled within our cluttered corners. So, grab your magnifying glass and dust off those heirlooms as we embark on a journey through the curious realm of stuff. Who knows what forgotten treasures we may unearth along the way. Today on WPRB News and Culture, we're delving into the fascinating world of all the things we own. First up, Helen Hoyer speaks to people in her community about their collections. Why do people collect the things they do? Do collections really matter? Next up, Stephanie Yen presents a piece on pieces of jewelry. From earrings to toe rings, people cherish these little things. Stephanie speaks to friends, jewelry makers, and jewelry shop owners, giving us a peek into the world of these ornaments. And finally, in a story from the archives, Oliver Wang follows Bill Freeman as he takes apart broken things and sells those parts to the junkyard. Stick around, we'll be right back.
WPRB wants you to know about the Philadelphia Reentry Coalition. They are a coalition of reentry service providers, practitioners, and advocates working in the Philly area to support people coming home to Philadelphia from jail or prison. The coalition's goal is to ensure people have autonomy and choice and play a central role in the reentry services and resources that they access. The coalition does this by increasing communication, facilitating collaboration, and building capacity of its member organizations. To get the latest about reentry in Philadelphia, or to find out how you can get involved, please visit PhiladelphiaReentryCoalition.org. That's PhiladelphiaReentryCoalition.org. This has been a public service announcement from WPRB Princeton, community-supported independent radio.
You're listening to WPRB News and Culture. First up, Helen Hoyer speaks to people in her community about their collections. Why do people collect the things they do? Do collections really matter?
Hello, this is Helen, and today I will be sharing with you guys a little collection of collections, so to speak. Collections and the reasoning, or lack thereof, behind them fascinate me, and I'm proud to say that I am a collector of many things myself. I like to think that I am not an entirely materialistic person, and I'm certainly not a fan of clutter, and yet I feel an almost innate desire to accumulate certain stuff. Like a magpie collecting shiny objects for my nest, some of my collections are purely based on aesthetic fixation. For example, over the past 2 years, I've collected things with strawberries. Something about the playful and feminine yet slightly bizarre vibe to them is just very compelling. In the past week, I've asked some of the people I encounter in my everyday life about collections. I was surprised to find that many of them had similarly inexplicable collections. So, I'm sitting here with Devin.
Hello.
Devin, do you collect anything?
Yeah, so I actually used to collect when I was younger these glass crystals from amusement parks, but I don't do that anymore. But I have a whole collection of them. I don't know what I wanted to do with them, probably just look at them, but I don't need them anymore.
Yet other things I and many others collect are just as much about sentimentality as they are beauty. Stickers are a great example, and probably a relatable one too. Wherever I go, be it a family vacation, a road trip, or a random event, I make sure to grab a sticker. My hoard has gotten pretty big by now, especially because I don't really put them on anything, and it brings me great joy and satisfaction just to look through all of them and relish not only the graphic art they display, but more so the memories they all represent. Perhaps this is why I don't buy them online or in bulk as I could. Their storied individuality and slow accumulation give them their value. Many of the people I interviewed also point to this sentimentality as a driving force. When you start collecting things, you see that, like, the items everywhere. Whereas before, I wouldn't have noticed that there was so much strawberry stuff for sale. Now it seems as though, like, it's everywhere. Did that ever happen to you with the glass animals?
Yeah, every single shop I would go into, I'd look for them being sold in the storefront. But they wouldn't have the same effect. I wouldn't want to, like, buy them, and I'd want to win them in the amusement slot machines. I wouldn't want to go into a shop, see them. I think, oh, that looks really pretty, but I wouldn't want to spend real money, so you call it, in the shops. I'd want to, I don't know, gamble it all away in the slot machines and win it by luck instead.
I think, yeah, that's a really good point. I think a lot of collections have kind of like a temporal and like circumstantial aspect. Like, yes, like you could just buy an entire collection, like go online and buy like every strawberry themed thing that you want. But there's something about accumulating it over time through the places where you happen to be. I totally agree. Another interviewee also pointed to this sentimentality. So today I'm interviewing Sean about his thoughts on collections. Sean, do you have any collections?
Right now I'd say I don't have any collections. I like to sort of collect water bottles because I love having a water bottle, but I lose them often. So I sort of collect them or, you know, get free water bottles whenever I can. I went to this a panel last night about being a history major, because I'm maybe gonna do it or not, and it was a very inspiring panel, and at the end they handed out free water bottles, so I obviously took a Department of History water bottle, and now that I look at it, it reminds me of how inspiring that panel was and how I'm excited to potentially pursue history as a major. So I feel like there's a lot of, you know, not only is the function of a collection important, but the time in which you got it and what memories it evokes. I think that's also a cool process.
Perhaps part of the allure of this slow accumulation strategy comes from an aspiration for something, the conscious or subconscious belief that this object signifies a quality that they, the collector, would like to possess themselves.
Ideally in the future, when I'm like an adult and I have adult money to spend, I'm gonna spend it on like collecting probably katanas, just because they're badass. And then definitely like art and, you know, decorative pieces in a home. But then maybe
like
some
katana.
Like katanas.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, all right, wait, last thought. You know what I think is cool about collections is like you're manifesting your passions into various memorabilia, and it reminds you of what, you know, piques your interest and, you know, what inspires you and stuff like that. I think some people might hate on collections as like a form of materialism and whatnot, but I think with everything there's a balance, right? And I think if you're truly passionate about something, I think it's like a sweet sentiment to collect items related to it. So yeah.
Even with the sentimentality and their ability to quote unquote manifest your passions, as Sean describes, some point to the collections as a gross symptom of consumer culture, a wasteful habit that ultimately leads to clutter. In fact, in recent years, and especially during the pandemic, the world seemed to identify this clutter with real mental consequences. Marie Kondo's life-changing magic of tidying up had Americans everywhere clearing out whatever was not currently sparking them joy in an effort to free their minds of excessive anxiety and stress. And there certainly may be some truth to this. After all, long before Kondo brought this practice to light, I would routinely wake up in the night to find my mom walking through our house with a trash bag, systematically throwing out all of the craft projects I had abandoned, any toys I had grown out of, any lip balm and newspapers and tchotchkes lying around, and really anything she deemed junk. It was stressful for her, apparently, to have things accumulating around her. And I guess I can see her point, especially in a system of economy that feels as though there is always one or really 10 things that we must buy now. Interestingly, though, the people I interviewed this week seemed to have different opinions about accumulating stuff. For the most part, they seemed adamant that their collections, present and future, were completely reasonable, if not necessary.
I'm a big nerd of Dune, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, maybe just like various little items or item or edition memorabilia related to those universes.
And that's something that you want to have. I feel like those are the kinds of collections that people end up accumulating and then kind of don't really want.
Oh, well, that's their problem. I don't know. I want to spend my money on ideally when I'm an adult, I have one nerd room where I just have a room filled with nerdy items that I'm into. So, yeah.
Another person I interviewed on Nassau Street was even more unapologetic about her collection. So I'm here with a fellow jelly cat enthusiast, but apparently you're also a collector of all stuffed animals. Is that true?
Yes, especially squishmallows.
Okay, so would you say that your collection is more a functional thing, or is it an aesthetic thing? Or is it just kind of a je ne sais quoi that, makes you want to keep accumulating more and more?
It's functional, definitely, because, it's my mound of stuffed animals. If I need to, lie down or work in my bed, I just create a little mound of squishmallows around me. So very functional, yes.
That's so interesting. I love looking at it that way, because I, too, have so many, things on my bed, and I feel like it's wasteful, and it makes me feel materialistic. But
it's not. No, it's very necessary.
Again, in contrast to the seemingly popular Kondo philosophy, one interviewee argued that we get rid of too much stuff, and that holding on to things, and thereby holding on to pieces of the past, is not necessarily negative, and can even be a form of thinking into the future. A couple days ago, I was getting my computer fixed for the 90th time with Sean, a man working in the tech department at Princeton. I noticed that he had quite a few tattoos, and I asked him if it had been a collection of his for a while. He said yes, and he said that he had many collections. In fact, the dice that covered his arms were representative of the D&D dice that he collected. He said that the tattoos and the D&D playing were addicting, and that he was still very much in the process of accumulating more. He also said he accumulated books. He said that he relished real pages and tactile stories because so much of what he worked with at his job was tech and screens. He also said that the books gave him something to pass down to his children and his nieces and nephews. He knew that even at their young age, one day they would appreciate the Stephen King novels that he coveted so dearly. And so, even though they couldn't read them now, he was waiting until the time when he could give them for Christmas and birthdays. In this way, it seemed to me that his collections were less about the past and holding on to it, so much as they were about him looking forward to the future. Along the same vein, collections often seem to become aspects of our identities for our loved ones to remember us by. My late grandmother, an avid cruise ship tourist, collected sparkly magnets from all of her travels. When she was alive, my cousins and I would gaze at them and repeat the names of all the exotic places: Aruba, Waikiki, Rio de Janeiro. Now, when I encounter those same types of magnets, I think of her and her perpetual tan very fondly. However, as Devin points out, the association between a person and the things they collect is hard to escape, especially when friends and family use it as an easy guide for Christmas and birthday presents.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I actually knew someone who, growing up, was just obsessed with Pooh Bear. And just everything was yellow or just had, like, Pooh Bear on it or, like, the Pooh Bear teddies. But when you grow out of it, what do you do with that kind of stuff?
It's also hard because it kind of becomes your, like, not your personality, but it becomes something that people associate with you. In kind of a crazy way. I have since kind of slowed down on collecting strawberry things, but literally any time my mom or my family members see something with strawberries, they like send me a photo and they're like, I thought of you. And it just, I don't know, it's a little weird now that I don't like it so much.
Yeah, so, that is actually so far. And I guess like...
With Pooh Bear, it would be even weirder, I guess.
Yeah, you're like, you know, I'm 50 and I'm receiving little teddy bears with Pooh Bear on, so...
It begs the question, what do we do with our collections once we're done with them? So while collecting too much suggests that one is approaching the dangerous label of hoarder, to be entirely too discerning and collecting nothing at all might deny a person and their loved ones sentimental joy in many forms. The general consensus seems to be that collections, in moderation, are completely harmless, if not a great bringer of joy. Even when people are not entirely sure why they collect what they do or what they will do with it in the end.
WPRB wants you to know that if you're a renter in Philadelphia, you should know your rights. PhillyTenant.org has everything you need to know about your rights and obligations as a tenant in Philadelphia. You can find information about security deposits, leases, evictions, repair, lead testing, housing assistance, and much more. That's PhillyTenant.org. Live help for low-income Philadelphia renters is also available by phone 9 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Friday at 267-443-2500. This has been a public service announcement from WPRV Princeton, community-supported independent radio.
You're listening to WPRB News and Culture. Next up, Stephanie Yen presents a piece on pieces of jewelry. From earrings to toe rings, people cherish these little things. Stephanie speaks to friends, jewelry makers, and jewelry shop owners, giving us a peek into the world of these ornaments.
What is the smallest analog item of value that you own? Many people might say a ring, a bracelet, or a necklace. The origins and significance of jewelry can be traced to the earliest human civilizations who created pieces using all sorts of materials, including shells and gemstones. To this day, jewelry remains a popular way of expressing personal style through meaningful materials and designs. Today, I will be exploring the personal stories and sentiments attached to small jewelry items through the various ways in which people have created and obtained them.
Also, my travel essentials are my Cartier bracelets. These are gold, white gold, rose gold. They're a headache to take off because you have to unscrew them with like a screwdriver. So I just keep them on all day, every day. I work out in them. They say the more scratches that you get, it gives them character. I'll go for that.
Loud. I wear jewelry just because it makes me feel a bit more confident. This is my favorite ring that I got. It was like the first purchase I made once I got a little more money in my pocket. These are like my favorite chains. Both of these are my parents when they were like 20, 21 or whatever. I'm very close to my parents.
Rings in general are a huge essential for me. They all are kind of sentimental to me. This one, my producer Dan got for me for Christmas, and he's one of my closest friends. My parents got me this one for my 18th birthday at some vintage store, and I think it's really special. This one, my makeup artist on High School Musical, I was filming this show, and I was really close with her, and she got me this ring when we wrapped, and it says, write the songs of your heart, and on the inside it says, love Heidi and Dottie June, which is her dog.
Those were the voices of Pusha T, Aminé, and Olivia Rodrigo describing some of their personal pieces of jewelry for a GQ interview series, focusing on the top 10 things they cannot live without. This isn't just a celebrity phenomenon, though. Many of my peers wear their favorite pieces of jewelry on a day-to-day basis. I chatted with my friends Lydia and Katie about their rings.
So my name is Lydia, and I'm currently wearing two rings. One of them is a little golden ladybug ring, and the other one is this purple ribbon kind of ring. The ladybug ring, my mom gave it to me, and my purple bow ring I actually bought a few weeks ago in Boston with my brother.
So my name is Katie. On my right hand, I have three rings, and my favorite of these rings is a very simple dark green resin band that I got in Singapore this past summer where I was doing research. And I'd been trying to find some sort of jade or jade adjacent ring for the entire 2 weeks I was there, and I was getting very unlucky. And then I think on the last day that I was shopping around in these Chinese markets, I came across a little jewelry stand that had these rings, and I was able to find one that fit me.
When asked if they wear their pieces every day, both agreed.
I've worn my ladybug ring every single day, maybe like the last 2 years or something. And as of right now, I just got my purple ring a couple weeks ago. So as of then, I've been wearing it pretty much every day.
Yeah, I used to like switch it up a bit more, but I've kind of either gotten lazy or settled into this routine, so I do wear it every day.
Their explanations for why were similar. Their rings reminded them of things that they were grateful for, whether that was family or nature.
With my golden ladybug ring, it was my mom, so it makes me feel closer to her, and she got it when she was around my age when she was living in Rome. And I guess with this bow ring, I thought it was really sweet because my brother was actually the one who picked it out, because he said that it kind of reminded him of me because I like the color purple a lot and I like to wear hair bows, so I thought that was really sweet.
I think it reminds me a bit of like where I've been. I think green is like a very peaceful color for me, so it's just kind of, it gives me this sort of peace and like reminds me of all like the things that I've been given and to be grateful for them.
My own pieces of jewelry tend to come from family members and small businesses. I appreciate knowing these sources as it adds to the beauty and story of each piece. Given this, I wanted to learn more about how people who design and make jewelry integrate various sources of inspiration and what they really think about the significance of jewelry. I was able to get in touch with two Etsy shop owners whose work I admire, Aubrey from Fena and Faye and Kate from Kate the Minimalist. Due to our different locations around the world, we chatted over text. First, I was curious about how these two women got started in making jewelry. Aubrey was inspired by the wholesale marketplace in Yiwu, China, which was one of the largest in the world, when she was living there in 2018. As she was browsing around the arts and crafts section of the market, she stumbled upon beautiful material. In her own words, there were hundreds of these blocks pasted on the wall of this small shop. I was so inspired by all the colors and shapes, and the possibilities seemed endless. That very same day, she bought charms and started making earrings as soon as she got back to her hotel. Kate's business was kickstarted when she designed a necklace which replicated the exact writing of her grandfather, after she received a sentimental letter from him while she was in college. As she wore this necklace, it constantly reminded her of her grandfather, and tons of friends and family started asking Kate for their own special personalized pieces of jewelry. It was also clear to me that both Aubrey and Kate see jewelry as means to connect with other people and the world. According to Aubrey, her connection to jewelry stems from her connection with her mother, who was a floral designer and wood crafter who was always making or creating something, displaying her art at booths and around the house. After her mother passed away in 2013, Aubrey's hobby of creating things out of colorful and eco-friendly material has allowed her to maintain her familial connection. Colors are also important to Aubrey's jewelry making process because it reminds her of the peace and beauty of the natural world. Kate and her team noted how sentimental value makes jewelry truly timeless and irreplaceable. With a special story behind every piece that she designs, Kate is dedicated to creating thoughtful pieces that are able to capture and reflect the unique personality of any owner. For example, Kate has a variety of pieces which incorporate colorful birthstones. Beyond Etsy, I recently visited a location of a chain jewelry store in Brooklyn. There, I chatted with a lovely employee named Rosie, who shared one of her favorite guest stories with me.
Well, the one story that comes to mind is this lady came in, and she had definitely looked online, so she kind of knew what she was wanting. or at least wanting to try on. And eventually she picked out this really pretty piece for herself.
Yeah.
And she told me at the end that it was because she was celebrating herself for completing her chemotherapy. And so she gifted herself some a really pretty bracelet. We don't have it anymore. But yeah, I was like, wow. And it was fun. It was really cool, like, interacting with her. Oftentimes, especially with the fine jewelry, because there are, like, higher prices, people need time and a little more, like, intentional, like, intimacy to, like, come to that, to what they want to buy. So sometimes I'm hanging out with people for hour plus.
Just picking out the
just
jewelry.
Just picking something out, yeah.
Yeah, it's so cute.
I was really inspired by this woman who, through an intentional act of gifting herself jewelry, empowered herself and celebrated all that she had gone through. I reflected on how choosing jewelry is a time-consuming and intimate process, like Rosie noted. This speaks to the personal emotion and thought that jewelry pieces can encapsulate. Before I left the store, Rosie and I quipped that I'll have to get myself special jewelry for my upcoming graduation in May. I'll have to spend some more time thinking about what I want. As I spent time learning about all that jewelry entails, from sourcing materials to daily wear, I was repeatedly struck by the layers of often hidden symbolism of jewelry. Chatting with others about their jewelry has not only given me insight into their personal tastes, but also into their values and their stories, which are inherently entangled in the things that they adorn themselves with. I have always loved observing jewelry in the wild, from classic gold bands to funky, colorful earrings. Now, I am further reminded of how jewelry can represent significant interpersonal connections, memories, and life events. It is a reminder of the deeply human experience of bestowing high emotional value onto even the tiniest physical items, what aliens might just consider stuff. With that, perhaps you would now consider keeping an eye out for pieces of jewelry that you would want to wear for years to come. Or if you are not a fan of jewelry, any wearable accessory, really.
You're listening to WPRB News and Culture. And finally, in a story from the archives, Oliver Wang follows Bill Freeman as he takes apart broken things and sells those parts to the junkyard.
There are a lot of sedans in the Spruce Circle parking lot. Toyotas, Subarus, one or two Hondas. They're mainly standard colors. Navy, slate gray, black. And they're all shiny. But Bill Freeman's car isn't shiny. It's actually kind of rusty. And it's peach colored. And it's also not a sedan. It's an 88 Mitsubishi pickup truck. So when I walked into the Spruce Circle parking lot, I saw it right away. I also saw Bill, because he was standing on top of his truck, leaning on his stove. He was holding a hammer and waving at a baby. He yells something I can't understand because he talks in a slightly garbled way. It sounds friendly though. The baby, looking over her mom's shoulder, doesn't react. She's probably confused. The hammer and the friendly wave give off mixed signals. Bill's truck is filled with old home appliances. A grill, an air conditioner unit, a lawn chair. The stove he tries to hand down to me, but I just let it fall on the ground. It looks heavy. Bill's gonna sell all these appliances back to the junkyard. It's what he calls junking. You drive around and pick up things people leave on the side of the road. Old things, broken things, things people don't want anymore. You drive them to the junkyard and you get paid. How much you get paid depends on the value of the metal you pick up on your way. Lead is rare but the most valuable. Then aluminum, copper and brass. Then iron, There are two types of iron, light and heavy, and then tin. It's really cheap. Bill takes the appliances apart to separate the metals. He's been doing this for so long, 50 years, that he has a pretty good sense of which metal is which. The top of the stove is iron, the body, aluminum, the wires inside, copper. But if he's not sure, he has another method.
You just got a magnet on it.
He uses a red clip that has a tiny little magnet on its back.
If it's a stick, that means it's iron. You hear that? That's iron.
Metal that sticks is less valuable. Lead and aluminum don't stick.
If it don't stick, it's worth more.
Really, it's worth more if it doesn't stick.
Uh-uh. It's stainless steel, it's not going to stick. I'll put that over there with
you. To separate the metal, Bill takes the appliances he finds apart. Most of his day is spent doing this. In the morning, he'll drive around Princeton, Trenton, and surrounding towns and throw stuff left on the side of the road in the back of his truck. Once it's full, he'll come back to Spruce Circle and disassemble it. There's kind of a hypnotic way Bill does this. Nothing about him is elegant in the normal sense of the word. He's got eyes that bug out asymmetrically, a bony back that's constantly stooped, and a bottom lip that juts forward. He'll slur his words and end sentences with mutters. He'll methodically shuffle around some appliance, poking at it with a screwdriver, eyeing it from under the brim of his hat, which is black and has an I heart Jesus written on it. Also, on the brim, says Jesus, second time, in red font. Bill works at the appliances methodically. He'll unscrew one thing, and then walk slowly around the truck, back to his tools, which he keeps behind the front seat. He'll grab a wrench and cut a wire, then walk back around the truck, slowly, to his tools again. Eventually, he'll decide it's ready and pull out a side of the appliance, or smack it with a hammer. It usually just falls apart. It's a stove.
Yeah, that was a stove.
It was a stove. There are three things lying behind the truck. Two AC units and a grill. The grill is lying on its side. The cooking tray was already taken out, and all that's left is the top, which is open and attached to one side of the frame. Bill is trying to unscrew it, but the screws are rusted over, pretty much buried in the side of the grill.
It's making me mad.
Making you mad?
Yeah. Very mad.
And so Bill goes over and grabs a wrench, about the size of his leg, from behind the truck seat. He walks over, slowly, methodically. What's that tool? Oh. Oh, God. Big rest. He drops it and walks inside, slowly. He walks back out with a sledgehammer dragging behind him.
More than one way to skin a cat.
Bill used to be a mechanic and garbage man and a cotton picker and hand at the loading docks. That was back when he was living in South Carolina, where he spent his youth. He didn't really have a choice when he was younger. He graduated high school, but afterwards, he had to work constantly.
Because we had to survive.
Being black in South Carolina in the 60s was not easy. Bill would work 16-hour days, and he was still poor. But he got in the habit of working to survive. He needed to do it. He's 76 now. Spruce Circle is a home for the low-income elderly in Princeton. And he still works, every day except Sunday, when he watches football and goes to church. On the weekdays, he'll get up in the morning, go to church, then get in his truck, the 88 Mitsubishi, and drive around. Bill spends some 10 hours a day doing this, junking. Because once he picks up all the roadside appliances, takes them apart, he stuffs the parts back into his truck, really high. I would be terrified to drive behind this.
Why?
Because what if something comes off?
No, it's not. I'll show you something.
Bill grabs this old tattered piece of rope out of his truck and starts tying it around the aluminum lawn chair that's balanced precariously high on top of a ridiculously high metal mound. He just loops it around things that look like they can be looped around. Then he grabs a bungee cord and hooks it onto two ends of the rope. There's no sense to it, as far as I can see, but he seems pretty satisfied. We get in the truck.
Now we ride?
It starts surprisingly well. The stack of metal in the back is ridiculous looking. People stare as we drive past. But when we pull up to the junkyard, no one stares. Well, at least no one stares at Bill. He's here three or more times a week. The workers do stare at me, though, with my audio equipment and bright blue shirt. I stand out there. Everyone else is kind of dressed like Bill. Loose-fitting clothes, steel-toed boots. Of course, they're in uniform, too. Bright construction vests. Bill and I pull up onto a big scale. 3340, the electronic numbers read. A voice tells us to move, and we pull through towards a huge open space with scraps of metal everywhere. There are three big machines out here. They each have big clawed hands, like in those boardwalk games where you try to pick up stuffed animals. One is methodically disassembling a giant shipping container. The open claw bends down and clamps onto it, crushing the metal and pulling it apart chunk by chunk. It tosses these chunks next to me and Bill. Bill and I unload the scrap metal from the back of his truck. We toss it on the ground. This is all the iron that Bill collected. Iron is the cheapest metal, and it just gets weighed and tossed into the junkyard haphazardly, as a whole. People will come along later to melt it down and turn it back into something to sell. The rest of the metal that Bill collected, the aluminum, the copper, the stainless steel, is bought separately by the junkyard. When we pull back out of the open space, the scale reads 2880, 2,880. Started, remember, with 3,340. So that was around 500 pounds of metal that we just tossed. We go up to the counter to pay.
How you doing today?
This is the man behind the desk. He's the one who told us to move forward on the scale.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and
have a great night. You got it.
All right.
Hands Bill $35.
All right.
$35. That's it. For a day's worth of work.
Right. Cash?
Huh?
It's some cash, right?
Yeah.
On the way back, Bill buys a sticky bun and a Coke. We drive back, this time in an empty truck. Again the next day, and the day after that, but not on Sunday. Sundays, he goes to church. There's no real beauty in the day-to-day work of junking. Like, you won't fall in love with it once you try it. You also won't get rich. I mean, if you listen to Bill, he'll tell you not to do it. Don't do what I'm doing, he'll say, laughing. But there's this sort of beauty when you look at the work as a whole. which is what you can do when you reach Bill's age. You can be reflective and habitual. There's a kind of beauty in the idea of collecting things every day. Old things, broken things, things no one wants anymore, things that were put together years and years ago. And then there's a beauty in taking them apart.
And that's our show. I'm your host and the show's producer, Natalie Hahn. Tonight's stories were reported, recorded, and produced by Helen Hoyer, Stephanie Yen, Oliver Wang, and yours truly, Natalie Hahn. The theme music for our show is Take Me Higher by Jazar. All music used is under Creative Commons license. For more information, visit our website at news.wprb.com. Can't get enough of WPRB News and Culture? Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or online at news.wprb.com. WPRB News and Culture is produced in Princeton, New Jersey, by WPRB 103.3 FM. Community supported, independent radio. Take care and enjoy your evening.